चंद बल बाग्रवर हरे गोपी जन बल बाग्रवर हरे शोर नंदन व्रज जन रंजन शोर नंदन व्रज जन रंजन यमुना तीर वन हरे यमुना तीर वन हरे जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी जय राधा माधव कुंज
Jai Om Vishnu Pad Paramahamsa Bhavraj Kachara Sukhair Sri Shri Srimad Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Srila Prabhupada Ki ISKCON Founder Charya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Samaveda Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai Gaur Premananda All glories to some of the devotees, all glories to some of the devotees, all glories to some of the devotees, all glories to Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. Namo Vishvaraya, Krishna Sahibhulay, Shimati Bhakta Vedanta Swami Tanamani, Namaste Sarasvati, Gauravana Vicharani, Nivishesha Shunivari Paskatadis Tani, Jai Srila Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Well, thank you all very much for being here. Today's class will be on the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 5, verse 24. And the title of today's class is Material and Spiritual Happiness. So let's go through this once or twice. Yonta sukontar aramas. Tantantar vyotjotir evaya. Sa yogi brahma nirvanam. Brahma bhuto digacchati. Yontak sukontar aramas. Tatantar jyotirevasya. Sa yogi brahma nirvanam. Brahma bhuto digacchati. Couple other people chant.
One more.
Okay, here's the purport by Srila Prabhupada. Unless one is able to relish happiness from within, how can one retire from the external engagements meant for deriving superficial happiness? A liberated person enjoys happiness by factual experience. He can, therefore, sit silently at any place and enjoy the activities of life from within. Such a liberated person no longer desires external material happiness. This state is called Brahma-bhuta, attaining which one is assured of going back home to Godhead, going back to Godhead, back to home. Okay, so we have a fairly short purport here. It's very packed, it's almost sutra-like, so just to kind of break this down a little bit. First of all, Bhagavad Gita is telling us that real happiness comes from within. Now, within obviously means it's on the spiritual platform, not within as in our mind or in our dreams or something like that, but on the spiritual level. Material happiness in this world certainly exists, but Srila Prabhupada is calling that external engagement. And that means that it's happiness that is related to the body, the senses, and the mind. These identifications with the gross and the subtle body, the mind, intelligence, ego, these are called the subtle body, where the basic elements and senses are considered the gross body that we experience. And it's very difficult to give up identification with those unless one has a higher experience of spiritual life. And that experience, as stated here, is found within, at the level of the Atma or the soul, the pure Jiva. So an advanced spiritualist, this verse is saying, can sit silently with no external sensory pleasure. But in that spiritual state, he's not miserable or without happiness. He's actually very joyous and completely happy. In fact, in the verse, there's some nice terms here. Antak sukha, antak arama, antak jyoti. Means happy from within, actively enjoying within, and aiming within. So this whole idea of seeing a real happiness in life and a real understanding from within the spiritual level of the self is being emphasized here. And then, of course, it ends with the result that he is assured of going back to Godhead, back to home. So it's a very, very nice verse in purport. And, of course, this needs a lot of unpacking, a lot of explanation. There's some inherent questions or assumptions that are here. First of all, why would one would give up material engagements? The verse is acting like that's a natural thing. Everybody would want to give up material engagements, but yet we see everybody's engaged in material engagements. They're part of life. They seem very natural. So what is the problem? The difficulty is in the material world, there's always suffering along with enjoyment. This is part of the duality of material nature. Much of human endeavor, of all the energy and activity that we see that mankind has exerted throughout centuries of civilization, has been basically, to put it very simplistically, we want to increase happiness and decrease suffering, right? Now that's natural. Nothing really wrong with that. That's a logical thing to do. Nobody particularly wants to suffer. In fact, reading the Science of Self-Realization, Chapter 8, Srila Prabhupada says, this is a reality in the material world. Nobody wants suffering, but yet it comes. So that's the reality. Everyone is experiencing something that we really don't want, which is suffering. And while we do experience some happiness, that has its limitations. First of all, that happiness also comes on its own accord, it's explained. In other words, you don't really have to separately endeavor. If you're going to be happy, you're going to be happy. If you're going to experience suffering, you're going to experience suffering. Of course, this is by the laws of karma. And we see this all the time in the material world. We see people who don't seem to have any particularly good qualities, and we wonder, how do they deserve this? Are wealthy, or they're famous, or they're like some kind of star or celebrity or like that. It's from their past lifetimes, from their past karma. Nothing they particularly did. They just are now receiving the benefit. But if they don't use that properly, they don't use all those benefits that they've received for good purposes, and then they accrue, of course, bad karma or negative results, and then they have to suffer in the next lifetime. So this goes on and on, and that's part of the problem. Often we experience happiness is really a cessation of pain. I was thinking the other day, I had this rare moment in my life when everything felt good. You know, when you're over 70, this is, like I say, a rare moment, you know. And I think, I really feel good today. And I think, why is that? I'm not experiencing any pain, you know. So this becomes more and more real, this example, especially as you get older. So it reminded me of a famous quote. Probably you are all too young, but there was a personality called Albert Schweitzer. Anyone ever heard of him? Okay, right. Very famous. He was a doctor, missionary, went to Africa in the early 1900s. But he was, you know, he just did all sorts of wonderful humanitarian work. He had this philosophy called reverence for life, which he became very famous, and he actually won a Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, in 1982. He wasn't completely a vegetarian, but the last several years of his life, he became a completely vegetarian. He had this idea of reverence for life. He was a person very much from the mode of goodness. So one of his quotes is, happiness is nothing more than good health and a bad memory. So, in other words, I'm feeling okay today and I'm forgetting all those other things about I felt in the past. So I think there's some truth in that in a humorous way. Now, basically science, medicine, which of course is what he was involved in, education, business, we can look through so many different types of scientific or social science ventures. And they're all really, in many ways, aimed at alleviating suffering in the material world. Now, we know that there are plenty of people who cheat and exploit and use all of these things for their own purposes, but let's say in its most pure form, you know, people mean well. We'll give them the benefit of the doubt for a moment, you know, that they have good intention and they want to alleviate the suffering in the material world. But the result is often an increase in suffering, even though they don't intend it. Famous verse, of course, by Prahlad Maharaj in the seventh canto, Srimad Bhagavatam, Maya Sukaya Param Udavahato Vimudham, that fools and rascals are making elaborate plans for material happiness. And this word Maya Sukaya, Sukaya means happiness, Maya means illusion. So it's an illusory happiness. And Prabhupada, this is in a lecture from Mayapur 74, talks about this word Maya Sukaya. He says, actually, this is a fact. We have a humbug civilization. One of Prabhupada's charming, you know, last century English expressions, I assume. So many cars are being manufactured every year, and for that purpose, so many roads have been excavated and prepared. This creates problem after problem. Therefore, Maya Sukaya, illusory happiness. Now, although science is trying to defeat material nature, conquer nature, now, that's really old-fashioned, isn't it? Now people try to live more in harmony, and you hear that a lot more. But back when I was young, this idea of conquering nature, people thought that was great. I mean, that was right. That was the thing to do. We want to defeat the material nature and get the best of it somehow. And so therefore they exploited everything and made a mess of things. But so now it isn't quite that extreme. But basically the problem is it doesn't work. Why? First reason. The attempt is futile. How much control do we have over nature? I think we're all reminded here in Florida every year of hurricane season, aren't we? We can barely even predict them, what to speak of controlling them. You know, it's like, we don't know what's gonna happen. Remember that one last year that changed course suddenly and like caused billions of dollars of damage in South Florida and we thought it was coming up here and it missed us completely? Totally random. Well, random. Not a blade of grass moves without the will of the Lord, but other than that, completely random. So we can't prevent these things. Economics, they've been studying for hundreds of years, well, a couple hundred years. We're not able to prevent recessions, wild fluctuations in the economy, even in very wealthy, very together economies like America. And even when we increase wealth, it neither protects one from unhappiness or necessarily increases one's happiness. I was studying this, doing a presentation a few years ago on this topic, and the Gallup polls have been doing these for years. Everyone knows the Gallup polls, particularly in politics, but they do these very extensive polls on all sorts of things like well-being, things like how are people feeling about themselves, about life, about happiness. And Gallup's actually a very religious person, does a lot on religion too, so they're really kind of interesting. So one thing that they found in these polls that at any given level of income, people who cared more about their income were less happy with life overall, their family life, their friendships, and their job. The result was the pursuit of making more money made people less happy. Now, that's not, you know, rocket science. That makes sense, doesn't it? If you put all of your energy and all of your work and everything into money making, you're going to neglect very important things in life, friendships, family, everything else. So, but in other words, these things that we know intuitively are borne out by research also. It was also interesting in the Gallup poll of 2008. Does anybody remember way back to 2008 what was happening in this country?
Recession.
What was it?
Recession.
Huge recession. At that point, richest country in the world, America, 62% of people said they were struggling or suffering. So all of this endeavor for, you know, material advancement, and the two-thirds of the people in the country say they're struggling or they're suffering. You know, we look at medicine. Now, many former epidemic diseases have been stopped. We're not all dying of typhoid, at least in America, maybe in other countries. But now we have cancer and stopping epidemics. I forgot about COVID. That was a little epidemic that came along. But what about the problems of mental health throughout the industrialized countries? Very, very severe problem. I mean, this and mental health issues have absolutely no recognition of socioeconomic status or money or anything else. In America, 48% of people suffer a major mental disorder in their lifetime, according to the National Institute of Mental Health, and 26% of the population in any given year suffer a major mental issue. So, again, material advancement, but, and you know, as many of you know, I'm a psychologist by training, and mental disturbance is more painful than many, many material or, you know, bodily issues or diseases. Trust me on this. So anyway, that was the first reason. Second reason, we often cause more harm than good. Think about the wonderful development of nuclear energy as a power source. And we got atomic bombs and nuclear bombs and all kinds of good stuff out of that one. Cars, we have pollution, expense, energy crisis, we have wars over oil. You know, so it's like there's this big trade-off. We're causing as much difficulty as we are good. But the third is the most important. We're ignoring the real problems of life. There's no focus on a spiritual solution to the real problems. And what are those real problems? Prabhupada says so often, there are four main obstacles to happiness in the material world. These are the real problems every single person has to face. Birth, death, disease, old age. Janma mrityu jara vyadhi. Nobody can get around these things. We all experience them. So they're there. And therefore, nobody can achieve a state of permanent happiness, even if you could have a pretty good life throughout this entire lifespan. You know, and this is found everywhere in the universe. Higher planets, lower planets, Bhagavad Gita says, Albrahma, Bhuvana, Loka, Punarvarti, Narjuna, Mama Pecha, Dagontaya, Punarjanma, Navijite, 8:16. From the highest planet to the lowest, all are places of misery, wherein repeated birth and death take place. So the nature of unhappiness and distress, what is its actual cause? Well, if we break it down, it comes down to bodily identification. It's the source of suffering. Because where is suffering experienced? It's experienced in the body, it's experienced in the senses, it's experienced in the mind. Not in the soul. Not in the soul property, not in the Atma or the self, but in the external body, gross or subtle body. And so, the attachment to the material body, when it's broken and one does not identify the self as the body, you do not experience suffering in the same way. It's not that material suffering is not there, but the experience of it being this sort of existential angst, life-shattering experience, you know, that just devastates people, devotees don't experience that so much. I was just outside before class speaking with one of my dear, beloved godbrothers about my age, and we were, I think we were laughing about it, pretty much. We're having a nice, you know, chuckle about all of our different infirmities and what the doctors were telling us and like that. I mean, you know, what can you do? You know, it's not like, it's not the self. It's not something to get, it's a problem you have to deal with, you have to take care of it, but, you know, it's not make or break for devotees. It's not our spiritual life. It's not a relationship with our spiritual master, with God. Like that, you know. But I want to emphasize, this is my prelude, the true state of a living entity is happiness, not suffering. We're not going to do a lot of focus on suffering. We want to do more focus on happiness. And what's the real happiness that the living entity can experience that's available to us by the grace of the Lord? And that's that happiness that is within, the experience of spiritual happiness. This is from Bhagavad Gita, 1854. The Prabhupada says, devotees experience spiritual happiness in relationship with Krishna. One who is thus transcendently situated at once realizes the Supreme Brahman and becomes fully joyful. He never laments or desires to have anything. He is equally disposed toward every living entity. In that state of pure devotion, he attains pure devotional service to me, 1854. So the enjoyment of the devotee within the spiritual body is in relationship to Krishna. Now, what does that mean? We need to understand what is the spiritual body. Excuse me. So many transcendentalists, spiritualists, yogis, you know, sadhus, so many people have some understanding of spirit, the nature that there's a spirit reality beyond this material existence. But many people of this ilk consider an impersonal understanding of that spiritual nature. So often people think that God is impersonal, and they also believe the soul is impersonal. So they'll see God and the soul as energy or light, some abstract force, or just a theoretical concept like love. Like they say, you know, God is love. Well, yeah, he is, but what else? In other words, yeah, you know, you can't just throw out a couple abstract words that are going to fully embrace, encompass the full meaning of who is God, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the spiritual body is less understood. That's understood by the Vaishnava. This is a great contribution of this Krishna conscious movement and the basically a Vaishnava religion in general. You know, of course, now even in India, you see that so many of the religionists have this more impersonal understanding, where the devotees of Krishna, the Vaishnavas, have always maintained for 5,000 years, you know, since more than that, but since our scriptures have been written down in written form, this idea that God is a person. We are persons, and we have a relationship, a personal relationship with God. Krishna is called Sat-Chit Ananda Vigraha, the original spiritual form of Godhead. This is found very nicely in Brahma Sanita, spoken by Lord Brahma, the first created person in this universe, Brahma Sanita 5.1. Ishvara Parama Krishna Sat-Chit Ananda Vigraha Nadir Adir Govinda Sarva Karana Karana. Krishna, who is known as Govinda, is the Supreme Godhead. He has an eternal, blissful, spiritual body. He is the origin of all, he has no other origin, and he is the prime cause of all causes. So this is saying many things, but first of all, Krishna is the original. You say, well, who is God? Krishna is God. Well, who created Krishna? No one. That's what God means. Anadir means original. Sarva Karana Karana, the cause of all other causes. So you go back far enough, you trace far enough back to the original personality of Godhead, where everything has come from, everything has emanated from, and you come to God in his form as Krishna. Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam. He is that original personality of God. And the living entity, all of us, the jiva, the soul, which is within these bodies right now, has the similar spiritual nature. So does that mean we are God also? No. We are eternal, we are full of knowledge, we are blissful. We also have those qualities in Sat-Chit-Ananda, but they are very small. And there's so many nice analogies that our Śrīla Prabhupāda and our gurus and acharyas have given us, like the spark coming out of the fire, or a ray of the sun coming from the sun, or a drop of water in a great ocean. In other words, same qualities, have many of the same qualities, same appearances, but very tiny. And not only tiny, but dependent on the original source. So while we have similar qualities to Krishna, Krishna is the original source, and we are the tiny sparks, the tiny drops, the rays that are coming from him. Now, of course, we also are eternal, full of knowledge and blissful, and we also have a spiritual body. How about that? Well, most of you all know. But the spiritual body, where is it now? Why don't we see our spiritual body? The spiritual form is now covered by the gross and subtle body. Prabhupada explains this many places, but this is from the Beyond Illusion and Doubt, a little book by Srila Prabhupada. The spirit soul is now within this material body, but originally the spirit soul has no material body. The spiritual body of the spirit soul is eternally existing. The material body is simply a coating of the spiritual body, but within there is the spirit soul. When we come to that platform, we become joyful. So Srila Prabhupada is that the material body is formed around the spiritual body, and he gives example like a glove around a hand. In other words, why does a glove have the form that it has? Well, because it's formed around, the glove is formed around the hand that's inside. So in the same way, we have a spiritual body which has, you could say, some resemblance to the human body, but it's only a resemblance because it doesn't have the same qualities. But it does have resemblance, so in other words, the human form of the human body more or less forms around the spiritual body. Now, of course, when we go into lower species of life, it isn't quite so direct. In other words, I'm trying to think of an example. It's not too gross, like a spider or a snake or something. But anyway, a snake body is not formed around the original spiritual body, snake spiritual body. No, it's not like that. You know, so in other words, I'm getting in too deep here. But the spiritual body basically is that spiritual existence that is there eternally. It is coming from Krishna, but at no time does it actually become created. It is eternally existing as Krishna is existing. As he says, his very first teaching to Arjuna in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall ever any of us ever cease to be, which establishes right from the beginning the eternal nature, the spiritual nature of the soul and of God together. So, next question. Here we are. We're the spirit soul. We're in a body. The body dies. Then what happens? Prabhupada says, it's stated that when a living entity gives up this material embodiment and enters into the spiritual world, he revives his spiritual body. And in the spiritual body, he can see the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face. He can hear and speak to him face to face, and he can understand the Supreme Personality as he is. Now, that's assuming, of course, that we leave this material world and are able to come to the spiritual world, and that's not an easy assumption because we need to become purified of all of our attachment to the material world, to the material energy, to this gross and subtle material body to be able to be in that position to go back to Krishna in the spiritual world. So how do we do that? How do we achieve a spiritual body? It's through this practice of sadhana bhakti. This process of sadhana bhakti that Srila Prabhupada has taught us all to do in line with all of the past, the disciplic session of spiritual masters going back 500 years to Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, his appearance on this earth going back 5,000 years and more. So in this unbroken disciplic succession of spiritual masters coming from Krishna himself, this spiritual knowledge has been given, and this practice of how to purify one's existence, how to break one's illusion and ignorance regarding what is material and what is spiritual, and be able to take up the process of devotional service, pure, loving devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and become happy again, and eventually get out of this material world and be able to go back to Krishna in the spiritual world. Prabhupada says, if by Krishna's grace we act in our spiritual body, we can transcend the gross and subtle bodies. In other words, we can gradually train ourselves to act in terms of the spiritual body. Devotional service means engaging the spiritual body and spiritual senses in the service of the Lord. When we engage in those activities, the actions and reactions of the gross and subtle body cease. So in other words, it's not an artificial process of trying to stop the senses or stop the body from acting. No, we can't do that. It's impossible. The body must act. The senses must act. So what we do is we transform those senses. We transform the mind to its real spiritual nature by engaging in spiritual activity. Just like we all have a propensity to hear things and to hear music and to whatever. So that entangles us. But if we engage that same sense of hearing, that same sense of singing or chanting or whatever, or talking to the Hare Krishna mantra, or to singing in kirtan or chanting, then that purifies that sense and enables us to come closer and closer to God, to Krishna. So 9:14 says, always chanting my glories, endeavoring with great determination, bowing down before me, these great souls perpetually worship me with devotion. So these are things that we need to do. And this becomes the basic of Krishna consciousness, of bhakti yoga. And bhakti yoga is really about understanding rasa. Rasa basically means relationship. So it's not about a impersonal or some dry process or intellectualized process, but it's actually making a connection, a relationship again with God and through and God's devotees. So the reality is God has a spiritual form. He's without material qualities, only spiritual qualities. That perfection is there in the spiritual world. But because of his great mercy, Krishna also appeared 5,000 years ago in that same original form in Vrindavan, in India, and he showed us, he exhibited his earthly pastimes, which are an exact replica. They're non-different than what goes on in the spiritual world. And fortunately, we have books, we have writings that have described those. So we know what God does. We know who his friends are. We know what his activities are. It seems very strange to people sometimes, well, how can you know that? Well, why would we not know that? Why wouldn't God want us to know all about him? Because everything God does is wonderful. It is beautiful. And his relationships with his devotees are so sweet. They are so loving. They are so filled with the highest love, which we call prema, spiritual love, that it's attractive to everybody's hearts. And it makes our hearts want to completely give up this rather boring, not very interesting material world for the beautiful world, the spiritual world of Krishna. So the basis of love between Krishna and the living entity is our true purpose in life. Now, that's based upon free will. God gives us that free will because we have small, minute qualities of the Lord, who is supremely independent, Svarat. We have independence, but in a very small amount. So free will is necessary. You could say, well, why did God make us so that we could leave, so we wouldn't be with him all the time? Well, you can't put a your gun to a person's head and say, you have to love me. It doesn't work. That's force. That's not love. So choice must be there. Free will must be there for the living entity, so that when we voluntarily make that choice to want to serve God, to return to him, then it's so much appreciated and it's such a wonderful exchange of love. So, of course, sometimes these verses are very elevated in philosophy, and we may not very easily be experiencing our relationship with Krishna in the beginning. So, how do we experience that? Well, we may not directly perceive a relationship with Krishna, but we often can experience a relationship with Krishna's devotees and the spiritual master. And that way, in the beginning, we start to cultivate what is the nature of spiritual relationships by our relationships with other spiritual seekers who are also trying to love Krishna as we are. So devotee relationships are spiritual by nature as long as the essence is Krishna being in the center of those relationships. And to the degree they're influenced by karma, jnana, sense gratification, material desires, then they're not so spiritual. It's very simple. No real mystery about it. So whatever we do, all the things that we have to do while in this material world, there's, we have so many duties. We have responsibilities to families. All this. This is fine. Those things can continue on. But we try to see everything as related to Krishna. I was just reading Bhaktivinoda Thakur was saying that we have two types. There's two types of bhakti, or two types of devotional service. One is sort of that direct devotional service, which is our Sanatana Dharma, hearing, chanting, etc. And one he calls it indirect or secondary bhakti. And that's like taking care of our family, doing our duties, doing the things that we have to do in life, you know, taking care of ourselves, going to the doctor, getting our bodies fixed up, things like that. So they're not direct devotional service, but they're indirect, but they are, because what is the purpose? It's always a question is, what is the purpose behind it? The purpose is to stay connected with Krishna, to be able to serve Krishna, have our families all be Krishna conscious, our children growing up be Krishna conscious, all of these things. So it all works very nicely together. And we have great affection for the devotees. Why? Krishna's the common father, so everybody is brothers and sisters. You know, you have a common father, you're all part of a family. And so there's a natural affection that is there. And when we see other people who are servants of the Lord, then that increases our own capacity or our own propensity for service to also want to do that. I was just reading Jiva Goswami, I was writing in the Preeti Sandarbha, that the reason that there's affection between devotees is because of the natural affection is there between the devotees and Krishna. So when we see another devotee, we see them as a receptacle of that preeti or affection or that love that is there with Krishna. And so therefore we become very happy, we become joyous on seeing other devotees, you know, who are reminding us of Krishna just by their nature. First of all, they're very beloved by Krishna, and secondly, they remind us because Krishna's love is within them. You know, so I guess my point here is we don't ever want to become impersonal. We want to understand what personalism means, that it is not dry, it's not speculative or impersonal. It is not that, like it's just me and Krishna alone and nobody else, right? But what I said, Krishna's never alone. You never see pictures of Krishna by himself. He's always with his devotees and with lots of devotees. In the spiritual world, sometimes they describe how there are thousands and millions of gopis or coward boys, whatever they might be. But yet, Krishna will appear in such a way that every single one of them think that Krishna is just with them. You know, just to make his devotees happy. And at the same time, they're all relating very happily together. You know, and actually very happy that Krishna is giving happiness to everyone else. You see this particularly in Radharani. Radharani is the embodiment of mercy. All wonderful qualities are with her, Krishna's beloved, we see. But she is almost more concerned with all the other devotees, that they are experiencing Krishna, that they are getting to be with Krishna. You know, because that's her very merciful nature. You know? And that's typical of the way a devotee thinks. A devotee's thinking not so much for themselves, but how can everybody else be happy? How can everybody else benefit? One of the prime qualities in devotee is compassion. So compassion must be there. Compassion for everyone. So sometimes we think, well, we'll be compassionate, you know, somebody's very favorable and likes us and everything else, but actually we should be compassionate to all living entities because they're all part and parcel of Krishna. That doesn't mean that we treat everyone exactly the same. There's distinctions that are made. You know, four types of people and all of that for the Majjhima Nikaya. But the basic understanding is there. You know, that there must be the sense of love, the sense of compassion, because if we're experiencing that from Krishna and our relationship with Krishna, we will naturally reflect that outward to others. And if we're not feeling that so much, then sometimes we need to, again, reassess, go back. What do I need to maybe do a little bit more? How do I need to get a little more connected with Krishna so that I feel that more? Okay. So I think I'm over time. I thank you all so much for your patience and listening. Are there any questions, thoughts, comments?
Thank you for your class, Prabhu. I was just thinking how...
Hare Krishna. I was just thinking how one of the last things you mentioned was how we should be careful to believe firmly in the Lord's personhood, the personality of Godhead. Srila Prabhupada didn't just say Godhead, he said the personality of Godhead. So in our attempt to ourselves be a person in this world, as you began the class speaking how oftentimes our suffering and even our happiness in a reflective negative sense is experienced that life is imperfect and we as people are imperfect, to err is human. And so when we think of God, or often when people think of God, then they're like, how can God be a person? Because, you know, by nature, me being a person, I'm so imperfect. And then in my struggle for, you know, happiness, I'm experiencing so much the opposite of that. So why do, you know, bad things happen to good people? I'm trying to be a good person. And obviously, if God is a person and he's all good, how come even his servants, his devotees, those trying to know him and serve him, even they are suffering? So that balance of, you know, understanding, could you speak a little bit about that?
It's a huge topic.
Just a huge one.
Okay. Was the gist of that, why are devotees suffering?
Yeah.
In this or
how do those even seeing devotees, you know, who suffer, how do they increase or keep their faith?
Okay.
How is our faith, clarified and kept even when we see suffering happening with devotees?
Well, we need to understand it philosophically, first of all. And in our scriptures, there's a number of good descriptions. One real good one I'd recommend reading is in the 88th chapter of the 10th canto. There's a discussion, and there's a very, very long purport by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, which is basically in the BBT volume, pretty much in the same is there. And Vishwanath talks about three or four reasons why devotees experience suffering. This is all in relationship to Prickett Maharaj's question, which is the question of why do we see that the devotees of Lord Shiva are materially prospering and devotees of Krishna are often in suffering conditions or in very poor conditions. So then that began the discussion. And basically, it comes down to, first of all, there's always a certain amount of what's called, residual karma, the winding down we're experiencing from past lifetimes. And that's very greatly reduced. So that's the first thing. If I'm suffering something, the devotee thinks I should be suffering much more. I'm getting a token punishment. Remember Prabhupada's example? When you're in the kitchen, the knife that cuts was meant to cut your throat. Prabhupada said that. In other words, that's a little token punishment you got cutting your finger from what you might have gotten beforehand. So that's first of all. Secondly, whatever experience that there is of suffering is winding down. Krishna's bringing it to an end. He gives example of pulling the plug on the fan, right? The fan winds down slowly, which means there's no new karma being created. If you're firmly situated as a devotee, you're not creating new karma, but there's some residual karma from the past that still might have to be played out. Thirdly, that karma that you experience, or it's not even really karma, it's something called Krishna karma or whatever, that reaction, is handled personally by Krishna. It is not mechanical. It's not based upon action and reaction from the modes of nature. The ordinary karma is, I do this to you, you do this to me. In spiritual life, Krishna directly handles that directly. I like to give the example that you throw a ball against the wall and it bounces back to you according to a certain way, trajectory, and it's very mechanical. At a certain angle it comes back at the same at a certain angle. Now, if I throw it and somebody catches it and tosses it back to me, that's very different. There's personal intervention. That's Krishna. Tossing it back rather than just mechanically coming back for, almost like no reason that you can understand. What else? Sometimes it's Krishna's arrangement. He wants you to learn. He wants you to experience something. Or sometimes, and a devotee always tries to figure, what am I learning from this? What is the learning opportunity? What's the teaching experience here for me? Right? That's how we always try to get other students. So, and we can't always figure it out at the time. Sometimes years later we'll understand, that's why that happened. That's why that was beneficial for me. And sometimes I've seen that things that were great suffering in my life, I thought at the time, somehow steered me in a different direction, which was very beneficial for my spiritual life. Krishna's more, it's the other thing to remember, Krishna's more concerned about your spiritual life than your material. Because the material, you know, happy is distress, you've suffered through many, many lifetimes, many different bodies. But Krishna's concerned about his devotees are coming back to him. So he's going to do what's necessary to bring you back. And there's several examples of this given in our scriptures. Okay. And then sometimes it's just Krishna's pastime. Why did Haridas Thakur get whipped and beaten in 21 marketplaces? Not his karma, it's pure devotee, right? It's a pastime. Now, I don't usually think of myself in those terms when I'm suffering. This is Krishna's special leela with me. No. But, you know, for great devotees, that is a case. And so sometimes Krishna wants to show the greatness of his devotees. The gopis couldn't understand, you know, when he left them before the Rasadan, why did you leave us? What did we do wrong? We are totally surrendered, 100% devotees. He said, well, I wanted to show your greatness, and I wanted to show the strength of your separation and all of that. And then he apologized for it, and he said, Napareyaham, you know, I can never repay you for your devotion, you know, that you, regardless of anything, you stay devoted to me. So sometimes they're tests. And sometimes I think sometimes Krishna arranges things just for us to surrender. They're just another opportunity for us to surrender more, become more and more dependent upon Krishna. And of course, being dependent on the Lord is one of the six symptoms of surrender. So, you know, it can be understood philosophically. But you also have to sort of feel it, you know, to get benefited from it. You know, you have to have some spiritual feeling of, yeah, I can kind of see that this will benefit me. Sorry, I told you it wasn't going to be an easy answer, a simple answer. And I probably missed some other points. People could probably help enlighten us.
Very nice, thank you.
Anything else?
I have a question. Just a simple.
You have mentioned
in the beginning, I say, when I think of my relationship with Krishna, I mostly focus on philosophically. Philosophically, he is here in a murti form, so like philosophy, not really practically, but then slowly, slowly I use that philosophy into practical experiencing. To see him spontaneously in that relationship, is there a shortcut way? Is there a tangible way?
Back off a little bit. To see him how in that relationship?
Practically.
Practically, okay, Krishna.
Yeah, then yes. Spontaneously.
Spontaneously.
And because we hear the spontaneous is our goal, spontaneous is our goal. So from your view, how to make spontaneous, in other words, speeding the philosophical to practical to that level. Is there a shortcut or?
Well, Prabhu, when you get there, I want you to tell me how you did it, and we'll, you know, you can help instruct me on how to get to the point of continuously seeing Krishna at all times. It's a process, you know. It takes time. We know the process. It's there in the books. It's there. Everything in Prabhupada's books is there in the Rupa Goswami's, you know, Bhakti Samrita Sindhu, he talks about the process of Raganuga, then Bhava, then Prema, you know. I guess my own experience that I'd say is sometimes with some of the writings by our acharyas make it sound like it's a very quick, easy process, and it has not been my experience, but maybe for others it is. You know, it takes time, you know, and we have to have some patience. That's one of the three qualities in the nectar of instruction is. But I guess I would say, if we want to accelerate our Krishna consciousness, I don't know any better ways than hearing and chanting. I haven't found anything better than just chanting japa the best we can, hearing the Bhagavatam, you know, our devotional service. I think we have the process. It's just applying ourselves to it as much as we can, as deeply as we can. And the only thing I would add to that also would be prayer. I pray a lot, yeah. Just keep praying for the mercy. Pray for the mercy of the deities, of Srila Prabhupada, of Krishna, and Lord Chaitanya. It's there. And my most simple answer to your question would be this. You have to want it.
Yes.
It's about desire. The more we desire Krishna, the more Krishna will show himself to us in many different ways.
Right?
Hare Krishna. Okay, all glories to Prabhupada.
Thank you.